All right, the first case on the docket is Wilson v. Slivka. Have counsel signed in?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
All right, terrific. Well, we're ready when you are. Thank you for braving the elements to be here today. I was concerned.
We were worried about when we got the notice in the, by email.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Wasserman for the appellant Philip Wilson.
Morning, sir. Can I reserve
it? I'd like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal.
6 minutes for rebuttal. Yes, sir.
So, Mr. Wilson's position today, if it pleases the court, Your Honors, is that the determination by the trial court is replete with error and requires some definitive rulings from the court and a remand. I think it's clear from the record that no determination of the actual incomes of the parties was made.
Let me ask you a question about that. On brief, it seems to be you're suggesting there's no evidence from which the trial court could conclude her income was $1,000 a month.
That's the third assignment of error, yes.
At page 195 of the joint appendix, it's a transcript, she testifies that her income is $1,000 a month. Except, I understand that you've challenged that, you challenged it in the trial court, said it couldn't be right, all of these things. But that is evidence that her income is $1,000 a month. And the question is whether a fact finder could believe that or not. So why is it so inherently incredible? Why is her testimony obviously wrong as a matter of law? Because if not, then we can't reverse the trial court's determination in that regard.
That would be if not, you couldn't reverse the trial court's determination only with respect to Ms. Slivka's income.
Okay.
There doesn't appear to be a determination of income in the record for Mr. Wilson.
Well, and I guess that gets to the next question. Regarding all the evidence he put on regarding his job search, was the trial court required to believe him?
Yes, unless his testimony was contradicted by evidence of record or otherwise inherently incredible.
Well, it's his burden, and if the fact finder just says, I don't believe you.
The fact finder cannot arbitrarily ignore the evidence put before the court unless it's inherently incredible.
How about if a witness is impeached? And it seems to me that the record read in the light most favorable to her, it could lead to the conclusion that he's less than forthcoming. He didn't provide information regarding certain financial information, regarding a severance pay issue. He withheld certain other information. He forgot certain documents. He didn't have them. Why can't the trial court, considering all of that, go, he's just not credible?
So let me go back to the first question about Ms. Slivka's income. With respect to the determination of her income, her own evidence was inherently contradictory, and the contradiction really can't be reconciled without at least some explanation by the court why it just makes no sense. And it is arbitrary for her to testify verbally to one thing and then present documents that are contradictory and clearly at variance, 180 degrees at variance with her verbal testimony. So there isn't a credible basis to determine her income. When the court sorts through those facts, the trial court has to engage in some level of analysis. It just simply cannot arbitrarily pick and choose between the appellee's own evidence, which is materially at odds with one bit of evidence is materially at odds with the other.
But our case law suggests that
a trial judge or a fact finder in evaluating evidence can hear evidence from 100 witnesses, and 99 of those witnesses can say one thing, and one of the witnesses can say something entirely different, and the trial judge as a fact finder, or the jury as a fact finder in some instances, is entitled to believe that one person, and we can't touch it unless there is nothing to support the statement made by that one witness.
As a general principle, I agree with that. But deference by the Court of Appeals, by the appellate court to the trial court's judgment, isn't complete, unbridled. There has to be, at minimum, some level of rational analysis applied by the trial court to explain how it came to its ruling.
And you were trial counsel, as I recall, correct?
I was not.
You were not trial counsel. But trial counsel, when the evidence was presented with regard to Ms. Silva's income, went through a very exhaustive cross-examination justifying where certain expenses were made, where income was coming from, what financial aspects she had, what she was doing with those aspects, the prospects that she was doing, how she was moving things around to enhance the business. There were a whole lot of things that were going on. There was a pretty good and exhaustive cross-examination, and even after that cross-examination, which I thought was a very good cross-examination, the trial judge still came up with $1,000.
And that was arbitrary and capricious.
Okay.
And look, I will concede that the appellate on that issue of Ms. Slipka's income is under a heavy burden here, because yes, if there, as I was instructed by this court and the Hatcher versus Matthews court, if there's even the court reminded me, and I conceded in oral argument, if there's even a scintilla of evidence, the court can latch onto that and do it. And what I'm saying here is that scintilla of evidence doesn't exist here. I mean, because even looked at in the light most favorably to the appellee.
So essentially, you recognize the standard, you embrace the standard, but suggest that even in light of the standard, you're still able to carry the day here.
Yes. Okay. All right. But, however, I want to return to Your Honor's earlier comment, Judge Russell. Your earlier inquiry. So if you look at the totality of Mr. Wilson's testimony, the evidence is unimpeached and uncontradicted that at the time of the trial, his income was zero. There's no evidence contradicting that. It's clearly recognized by the trial court that he was collecting unemployment compensation and that when he got to the hearing, the unemployment compensation had ceased.
Wasn't there evidence in the record that he had received substantial sums as a severance from his prior employment and that he had a substantial tax refund?
There was.
Money in the bank?
Yes.
All not disclosed?
No, they were disclosed. That's why the evidence was out there. So there was not
timely disclosed, not on the income statement ahead of trial. The severance payment was discovered after he had represented it.
So that may be, and the court's entitled to say it wasn't timely disclosed. Nonetheless, the court didn't sanction him. There's no evidence of that. So the court still considered the totality of the evidence and considered it. What's relevant for child support determination is there's two components of it. There's the period of retroactivity back to when he filed, and then there's what his income is at the time of trial. The court is, of course, able to income under the statute. The court can consider all his different sources of income over the period of retroactivity and make multiple guideline calculations, or it can simply average it over the period of retroactivity. That would be something for the court to determine on remand.
You're focusing on income. Was there any evidence regarding any change in expenses regarding the children?
No. And that wouldn't have been relevant to a determination of presumptive guideline support anyway. What the court had to do was look at his income at the time, the trial court, look at his income at the time of trial. His unemployment income insurance had just run out. The trial court conceded that it was prima facie evidence that he was making. Conceded that he had applied for unemployment insurance compensation and was receiving it, so he presumptively was looking for work during the period of retroactivity. When he got to trial, his income was zero. That's not contradicted anywhere in the record, and there's no finding by the court that at that time, that testimony was inherently incredible.
But the only source of that information was him.
It was not. He had documentary evidence from the unemployment VEC, the Virginia Employment Commission, to substantiate that. So there was corroborating evidence, too. The court can't ignore that and shouldn't, and they did. Now, if in fact the court was going to determine for the period of retroactivity that he got a severance pay, and maybe that should have been applied for a portion of the period of retroactivity in some manner, then yes, that would be something that the court could be instructed by the court upon remand to take care of. And I would encourage the court to do so. I mean, we have to look at this as two distinct periods. You know, what was the evidence presented of his current income at the time of trial? What was his income and evidence during the period of the remand? I see that I'm into my time for rebuttal, so if I may.
Yes, sir. Thank you. For the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Valerie Hughes, and I represent Hannah Slifka. The important thing to note in
counsel, is this an imputation of income case, or is this a guideline baseline case? That's what I call it. We establish what the salary is, and we work from there. Is it an imputation case, or is it a guideline baseline case?
It is not an imputation case. It is not a deviation case. The judge did not find his testimony credible. They offered zero in income. My client put in his other income. The court noted that he stated he represents he has no job. She didn't say he has no job. She said he represents he has no job. She found him to be incredible. Under Hatcher, he had the mistaken assumption that what he said was what she had to take. She had the choice of zero or evidence to the contrary. He was standing there with two expensive lawyers. He was taking his girlfriend out to dinner. He had a guideline full of stuff.
Your firm's a good firm, too, and does very well. I know you're paying her pretty well. She does quite well for herself, so the scales are balanced in that regard.
Yes, Your Honor. Also, the judge put, for all the reasons stated in open court, and incorporated her findings by reference, which under 2108.1, you can incorporate by reference. She did three pages of findings, including his income and including his missing discovery. And then in the final order, she put incomes, child care, health insurance, and then she went through it again. She said find, not impute. And nowhere in the record are you going to find this judge saying, I imputed, I deviated.
And that may be fair as to what she said. Is there any evidence at all, or are we just here on a failure of his evidence to establish a change in his income, despite the VEC documents, despite the fact that I think it's conceded, essentially, that he at least no longer had the job that was paying him the $141,000? How do we get to $141,000 still being the income unless she's imputing something?
Because under Bolton, Your Honor, she can disregard any testimony that she hears, and she heard multiple times about money he had, money he was spending, and income coming in.
But the judge couldn't disregard that he was no longer working at that job, could it?
She didn't disregard it, Your Honor. She, in fact, said you could get another job in the transcript, and I concede that. But what she did was she has had this case for a long time, and she has imputed income before, but this time she did not, because she said that this was the measure of his worth. I find $141,000 to be his worth. And this doesn't come in a vacuum. It's a long history.
But it seems to me that's a potential problem. If she says, I don't have enough evidence to believe that his income has dropped from $141,000, that may be one thing. However, it is hard to believe that it is uncontested that he lost the job that was paying him $141,000, setting aside why he lost it, how he lost it, setting all of that aside. And it turns out that looking at just his core assets, that they're going to spin off $141,000, the exact same amount in income. I mean, it's possible, but that's highly coincidental. So is it she said he didn't prove that his income had changed, or is it that she found that his income now, despite having lost the job, was exactly the same as what it was when he had the job?
Your Honor, I don't believe that she felt that his income had changed. And also what she did was she applied all the testimony that she heard to him, and she said, you're asking me to zero you out, and I'm not going to do that. And she called it the value of his worth. And, Your Honor, if you, in James versus Owen, if there's a non-constitutional error, if the parties had a fair trial, if it had a result that substantial justice has been reached, then the judgment should stand. What would happen here, because she did what she thought was right, and she did, she felt that she did the presumptive guideline. If you send it back...
If his income true, despite having lots of assets that would enable him to pay the award, let's assume that, but if his income is zero, does she have to calculate a guideline amount and then say, because of his assets, we're deviating from the guidelines because he has enough assets to pay it, despite the fact that his income is less than $141,000? I mean, you seem to be saying that what she said is, looking at this holistically, looking at all the sources of money available to you, you can afford this, this is fair, this is appropriate, this is what your children need. And I'm not saying she couldn't get there, but the question is, if there has been a change in his income, does she have to run the guidelines with the changed income and then then announce a deviation from it if she finds one appropriate?
Your Honor, yes. If a person came in and they were making $141,000 and then they came in and gave concrete proof that now they were making $20,000 and showed the W-2s and the discovery, which he withheld, if they did that, then she would have to do that presumptive first and then go ahead and impute. But he did not prove that he had nothing. In fact, to the contrary, he was withholding evidence from 2016 all the way through to trial. And so she had to go with what she found was credible.
Did you contest that he was no longer working for the employer that had been paying him $141,000 when the guidelines were initially written?
No, Your Honor. She did not contest that he did not have that job. She affirmed that. But because of the long history, she said he represents he doesn't have a job. Okay, she knows there's money coming somewhere, but no one could prove it because of the lack of discovery. And the other side said that she didn't make adverse findings on his veracity, but she did on the credibility. She said poor track record, that he's not paid, she's going to take into consideration noncompliance with orders, appalling, spent money on yourself, not your kids.
Those are all interesting facts, but wouldn't those facts necessarily suggest that the result that the trial judge reached was punitive in nature? In other words, she was upset with the way that he had maybe disregarded the discovery process, had not been candid in the information that he provided, had done all these things to undermine the court being able to make a determination. So therefore, from a punitive standpoint, I'm just going to say it's 141, which is what it was from the very beginning.
I don't believe it was punitive at all, Your Honor, because unlike other courts, this court was very familiar with financial history and job history. And so when she fixed the sum on him, which is the only number she had other than zero, she did it in the idea of a fair trial and fair to these children, and she decided that that was the number that would be the presumptive guideline. And you can't deviate from something that wasn't...
In the child support modification context, as the party seeking the modification, do we start with the baseline that nothing happens until the court determines an income and runs the guidelines, or does he have the burden to show that his income has changed?
He has the burden to show that his income has changed, and then our client has the burden to show that he's willfully unemployed, and then it shifts back that he's not. And he did not show that he was without income. What he did is he showed he was hiding it.
So the trial court defaulted to his previous income level based on what the court had heard in previous hearings, and on the basis of credibility decided that husband had not carried his burden to show a change and plugged that in. That's the only way that we get to a non-deviation from the guidelines.
Exactly, Your Honor. She did not feel that the proof was given to her to change to zero or some other number. And in their second argument, you can't deviate from the presumptive guideline if the presumptive guideline is the only thing she put in. She didn't do the first step of zero because she completely did not buy it. And this court Case law says that this court defines the finder of fact is the one that can see the live testimony and to know what's going on. And the circumstances of a particular case in Turner versus Commonwealth may raise other factors that the circuit court takes into consideration that this court, by not seeing the live testimony, won't see. I did want to address one thing, Your Honor, with the $1,000 a month. When the judge said she could tell whether the business expenses were legitimate or not, and she said it as a question, counsel said, sort of, and rested. There was no follow-up on that. And the other thing I wanted to bring to this court's attention is on attorney's fees. The attorney's fees were offered from the appellee, and the judge said, is there any objection? And the other side said, no objection as long as I can put mine in.
Well,
done.
Well, and the other thing I'll note, just it struck me that looking at all that was going on below, that 40 hours, that's not one of those that just automatically shocks my conscience, given how much was involved with discovery motions and such below. But I'm sure Mr. Bowserman will have some comment on that in a moment.
Your Honor, basically what we're looking at here is that the court reached out to the evidence that she found credible, which is a continuation of the income before, because the father did not prove that he made zero, and he offered no proof of any other sort of thing, but he clearly wasn't starving to death of living on zero. She made adverse determinations of credibility. She said, for all the reasons stated on the record, and she did 3 pages of findings on the record and then referenced it in the final order and then also made a bunch of findings in the final order. And so, Your Honor, if it's written words that you're looking for this, which is what they want, written findings, she incorporated the transcript and her findings, and then she made more findings in the record. If this goes back and it's non-constitutional error, the judge has already displayed what she believes to be the presumptive amount, and so it's going to cost so much money for her to just write it down when it's already in here. And it's,
but we need not go through that drill unless we're making a determination that what she essentially did was imputed income.
Right.
No, there are no written findings required if we're, again, doing a baseline guideline child support determination.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Even though she did make some, she's not required to do it. And this judge believed it was the presumptive amount. She calls it the correct amount in there, but she did not ever say she imputed, and she's imputed this guy before, but she did not say this time. Also, let's see if there's, are there any other questions, Your Honor? Because I think I've covered it pretty much with Hatcher and Von Hassel, that the business expenses are reasonable, that she doesn't have to take incredible evidence. He didn't make his burden to show he was zero. And are there any other questions, Your Honor?
Appears none. Thank you, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Bowserman, your rebuttal.
Yes,
if you would, on the issue of fees, why isn't that, why shouldn't we default that under Rule 5A18? No objection.
What he was not objecting to is the introduction of the fees affidavit for consideration by the court. He wasn't defaulting to and saying, okay, apply the winner-take-all standard. I mean, I quoted in the brief the specific language the judge used.
So essentially what you're saying is a reasonable reading of the record would suggest that he was not objecting to the presentation of the evidence, was not conceding that attorney's fees were appropriate in the case.
That's right. He was just simply not objecting to the affidavit. I mean, the court understands for practical reasons you don't necessarily want to say, ha-ha, you have to bring in an expert to testify to the reasonableness of your fees. It's routine for counsel at trial to not object to the introduction of the evidence of the opposing party's fees affidavit for consideration by the court.
So the reason,
that doesn't mean that they're receiving it without objection
the reasonableness of the fees is not being disputed.
You contest the award, but not the reasonableness. That's about the best you're going to do, I think.
That would be a decision to be made on remand, because the court, when the court uses the English rule, the winner-take-all rule, and the court clearly applied the wrong standard, then we don't even get to the second question of whether the fees were reasonable. The court has to go back and decide whether the fees were reasonable upon remand. And she just applied the trial court applied the wrong legal standard. That's clear and reversible error.
Mr. Bousman,
it's not harmless error.
We don't, Bousman, you and I have known each other for a long time. You know that I respect your ability and the way that you practice law. You know that. But I'm looking at the work of trial counsel, and it seems to me that they could not, trial counsel could, and that was not you, I want to make sure that everyone knows that, could not have been more difficult with regard to the discovery process and preparing this case to mature to actually get to the issue that your client wanted to raise. Why isn't an appropriate situation for the award of attorney fees?
There was disputed discovery and accusations made by both sides as to the insufficiency of the timeliness of the discovery being turned over. There also appears to be in the record a decision by a ruling by the trial court. First of all, the discovery dispute had to do with whether Mr. Wilson turned over not some, but all of, what quantity of his job search information he provided in discovery. And the court resolved that at the trial level in his favor. The court accepted the evidence of his job searches and considered it. So it may be that the appellee's trial counsel complained, oh, I didn't get this in time, oh, he shouldn't be allowed to present the evidence, but the trial court allowed him to present it. This court is required to defer to the judgment of the trial court. The discovery dispute was resolved in the
appellee's favor. Only about some things, huh?
Of course, I want you to the court to treat every argument I have as a holy golden nugget. But no, showing due deference to the trial court in the discovery issue, notwithstanding the appellee's objections to the alleged incompleteness or lateness of the discovery, the trial court accepted all of his evidence of his job searches, received that, and didn't impose any sanction.
One question on the attorney's fees and then one question on income. You make a big deal in the brief about block billing. Is there any case or statute that says that block billing is impermissible? It may not be wise. It may subject you to the trial court going, this is unreasonable. But now we're back to, given everything that happened, 40 hours does not strike me as a terribly inflated bill. And although it's not in the record, I'm tempted to ask how many hours did his attorney spend at the trial court?
I can't recall, and that frankly, I didn't review that in preparing for this.
You pretty confident it's within the neighborhood of 40 hours?
I'm pretty confident it's within the neighborhood of 40 hours.
Okay.
It's not unreasonable per se, but it of course, the way that it's documented, the way that it's presented to the court does make a difference.
Okay.
I mean, I can't say that there's a per se rule. No, it doesn't strike, I'll be candid, it doesn't strike me as per se unreasonable. But we don't even get to that analysis if the trial court applies the wrong legal standard. They did. It needs to be remanded. And then the trial judge can say, hey, it's not inherently unreasonable, and here's my rationale for shifting all the fees or a portion of the fees to the appellant. That wasn't done. How can we have any confidence in the trial court's decision on this issue when the trial court applied the wrong legal standard?
Now my income question. Do you agree with your opponent that as the party seeking the modification of child support, it was his obligation to produce evidence that his income had changed? He had a burden.
Yes.
If you move for a change in child support, and you put on zero evidence that there has been a change in your income, literally nothing. You just come and say, I want a change. They say, what's your evidence of income? Didn't bring any. Is it okay for the trial court to use the prior income amount, or does the trial court have an independent duty to act as its own, dig around and be a detective and come up with a number and rerun the guidelines?
The trial court does not have a duty to get some detective to dig around. The moving party has the burden to put on at least some credible evidence to substantiate their claim.
If the trial court finds the evidence not credible, that's the legal equivalent of there being no evidence, isn't it? Not saying that the trial court...
On a level of generality, yes.
Okay.
Now, this is an imputation case. If it's not a guideline baseline case. If that's the standard this court wants to adopt in this case, then you're simply rendering the requirement of the statute that the judge make detailed findings a legal nullity, because because we could just look at the totality of the record and say, oh, we're inferring the trial court found that the appellant's evidence was not credible. No. If the trial court finds the appellant's evidence not credible, the trial court must say so. If that's not specifically said here.
If you can wrap it.
Yes.
Thanks.
There has to be a record on review for this court to make a decision as to whether the trial court followed the statute, and that requires detailed written findings. That's omitted in this case. And unlike Hatcher versus Matthews, where the court instructed me, and I was the appellant on that, the appellant's counsel in that case, that there is a specific finding of lack of credibility, even a scintilla, because Mr. Hatcher had been determined in 2009, 6 years before we had the hearing, to have made a misrepresentation to a court in Fairfax, ironically during a discovery dispute. The court said, you're not credible. Yeah. That's the court's prerogative. There's nothing like that here.
We understand. Thank you very much. In keeping with the tradition of the court, we will step down and greet counsel, and thereafter we'll take up the case of Vozdovic.